welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about the treatment of opioid use disorders. We are all aware that there is currently an opioid epidemic in the United States, in fact, in many parts of the world, and while prescribing opioids has significantly curtailed in the past few years, the incidence of opioid-related deaths continues to climb. The illicit use of opioids remains a significant and growing problem. Many patients want treatment, but the lack of access to effective treatments has stymied our efforts to reduce opioid-related deaths. Joining me today to talk about a recent study which compared the safety and effectiveness of two treatment options for opioid use disorder is Jordan Wolls. Dr. Wolls is Assistant Professor of Pharmacy Practice at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and practices in pain management at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's in Milwaukee. Jordan, welcome to the iFormRx podcast.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. I'm excited to be here. I've been a longtime reader of iFormRx and now first-time writer.
Before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing ML, a 52-year-old white female, in the anticoagulation clinic for routine INR monitoring. The patient has a mechanical heart valve in the mitral position, which was placed about 3 years ago. The patient has a history of substance abuse. She admits to using oxycodone and heroin. She also has high blood pressure and is obese. The patient developed infective endocarditis, which caused valvular damage, and that eventually required the valve replacement. At that time, she participated in a 12-week substance abuse program and has been abstinent for the past 3 years. The patient moved to your city about a year ago. A patient currently takes warfarin and irbesartan plus hydrochlorothiazide. And according to the medical records that you received from the anticoagulation clinic where she previously received care, her INR was stable. But since arriving at your clinic, her first two INR measurements were within her goal range, but have since fluctuated very significantly. Moreover, she has missed several appointments. Her INR today is 1.4. You suspect the patient may be experiencing a relapse of her substance use disorder. Unfortunately, there's no certified substance abuse treatment program in your city, and although one of the physicians who refers patients to your clinic has received a buprenorphine prescribing waiver, her patient panel is often full. So, Jordan, before we talk about the study reviewed for iFormRx, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things going through your mind in this case? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And what are the options you'd be considering at this point?
One of the first things that pops out to me with this case is the patient's history of infective endocarditis. With no other relevant history but a history of substance abuse, it's likely the patient developed the infective endocarditis from previous IV drug use. Often when we think of the opioid epidemic, many will cite the overdose death statistics, which are certainly tragic, but what often gets missed is the multitude of other public health consequences stemming from substance abuse, including the spread of infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C due to using and sharing unclean needles. More recently, we are seeing an uptick in infective endocarditis cases related to IV drug use as well. An article I read recently labeled the opioid crisis as an epidemic of epidemics, which I think is sadly true. Now, it's certainly concerning for any warfarin-managed patient to miss appointments, especially if their INRs have been fluctuating. Considering this patient's history of substance abuse and no current medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, it would not be unlikely for this patient to relapse. I think for many pharmacy practitioners in ambulatory care, opioid use disorder is not the first thing on our minds when we are managing chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, etc. But as many of us know, even if we are only seeing this patient in a dedicated anticoagulation clinic, other comorbidities or medical problems are often discovered during these visits. If I'm working in this type of setting, then anticoagulation is likely my bread and butter. But it's important to realize that my goal of getting this patient's INR within range likely will not be achieved with any warfarin dose change until this patient's substance use disorder is managed appropriately. So even though opioid use disorder may not be your specialty, it is clearly playing a role in this patient's subtherapeutic INR level and is the first thing that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, as indicated in this case, medication-assisted treatment with methadone and buprenorphine is often difficult to access for many reasons, including geography and prescribing restrictions. Most opioid treatment programs are located only in urban settings, and though there are a number of buprenorphine-waivered clinicians, not all of them utilize this waiver, and others are limited to a specific number of patients they can manage at one time. In terms of additional information I might want to know, I think I would start by asking the patient what has been causing them to miss their appointments. Of course, in an anticoagulation visit, it's always important to ask about warfarin adherence, new medications or supplements, etc. But if their answers aren't lining up with the objective data, I think it's reasonable to directly ask the patient if they have been having trouble with using oxycodone or heroin again. As long as you have a relationship with the patient built on trust, they likely will tell you if they have been abusing opioids again. I think the majority of patients with substance use disorder do not want to be using and would appreciate help in getting clean. If they do not admit to drug use, but you still think this might be the cause of their missed appointments and subtherapeutic INR, I also think it's reasonable to get a urine drug screen to confirm. If it is confirmed that the patient has relapsed, I would certainly recommend medication-assisted treatment. Her three options would be methadone, buprenorphine products, or intramuscular naltrexone. However, since there's no opioid treatment program in her city, methadone can't be used. My next step would be to search the SAMHSA database for buprenorphine-waivered clinicians in the area to see if buprenorphine might be an option for her. I would also consider Vivitrol, which is intramuscular naltrexone, and it has no prescribing restrictions. However, if the patient has relapsed, they would have to go at least 7 days without using opioids to avoid immediate withdrawal with Vivitrol administration.
So, Jordan, the research article you reviewed in your commentary is entitled Comparative Effectiveness of Extended-Release Naltrexone versus Buprenorphine Naltrexone for Opioid Relapse Prevention, and it's called the XBOT study, a multicenter, open-labeled, randomized controlled trial. The XBOT study was published online in November 2017 in The Lancet. So for those in our audience who haven't read this paper, can you give us a brief summary of its methods and major findings?
Sure. So the XBOT study was an open-label, randomized, controlled, comparative effectiveness trial that compared the safety and effectiveness of two FDA-approved treatment options for opioid use disorder. The comparison was between daily sublingual buprenorphine naloxone, otherwise known as Suboxone, and a monthly intramuscular naltrexone injection, otherwise known as Vivitrol. This was the first study in the United States comparing IM naltrexone to a current standard of care for opioid use disorder. Participants were included in the trial if they were diagnosed with opioid use disorder and had used non-prescribed opioids in the last 30 days. The primary outcome looked at opioid relapse-free survival during 24 weeks of outpatient treatment following detoxification and induction in an inpatient setting. Relapse was defined as 4 consecutive weeks of any non-study opioid use as determined by urine drug screen or self-report. Relapse was also defined as 7 consecutive days of self-reported use. There were about 280 patients in each group, and the results varied significantly based on the population being assessed. For example, the intention to treat results indicated that buprenorphine naloxone was significantly superior to IM naltrexone in increasing relapse-free survival and decreasing opioid relapses. However, in the per-protocol results, there were no statistically significant differences between the two groups.
So tell us a little bit about what you believe to be the key strengths and limitations of the XBOT study. And are there any major sources of bias, confounders, or other threats to the internal validity of the study?
Well, because this was a comparative effectiveness trial, the investigators really wanted to ensure that they designed it in a way that would closely mimic reality, especially for those at highest risk for an opioid-related overdose. With this in mind, they recruited patients from inpatient detoxification facilities. Additionally, the investigators did not standardize detoxification protocols between these facilities and instead allowed them to operate as they normally would. This likely led to the variability seen between the intention to treat and per protocol results. many of the participants were not able to be inducted onto IM naltrexone because of the need to be opioid free for at least 7 to 10 days. And because of this, they dropped out of the study, which actually was then counted as a relapse event. However, when the induction success was similar between the groups as seen in the per protocol population, there were no significant differences in opioid relapse or relapse-free survival between the two groups, which indicates that IM naltrexone is as effective as buprenorphine in the treatment of opioid use disorder when patients are successfully inducted. One of the limitations of this study is the open label design, and they also didn't compare it to methadone, which is another standard of care commonly used for opioid use disorder and really has been the treatment that's been around the longest for this disease.
Well, Jordan, as you know, research is only useful if it can be translated into practice. Do you think these findings are sufficiently compelling to change clinical practice guidelines? And assuming that ML, our patient case, is able to receive acute treatment, the induction treatment, what do you believe is the best option to prevent relapse for her? And lastly, how can pharmacists become more involved in the care of patients with opioid use disorder?
That's a great question, Stuart. I think these findings are enough to change guidelines. When you look at the different practice guidelines available for OUD, some are already advocating for IM naltrexone as a viable therapy option, and others are simply outdated. For example, the APA guidelines on substance use disorders was last updated in 2006 before Vivitrol was even FDA approved for opioid use disorder. Additionally, the SAMHSA Treatment Improvement Protocol, which was published this year, 2018, includes this study in their review of treatment options. In my opinion, the more medication options we have for opioid use disorder, the better. IM naltrexone is certainly not without its own risks when compared to buprenorphine or methadone, but it's likely to be much more accessible due to the lack of prescribing restrictions. Additionally, it may be more palatable for patients and providers who associate a negative stigma with being maintained on an opioid. Personally, I'm an advocate for methadone and buprenorphine treatment for opioid use disorder because it allows your users to maintain their sobriety and contribute to society by going back to work and reconstructing their relationships with family and friends. But ultimately, I believe IM naltrexone is an accessible treatment option for OUD, and each patient really needs to be assessed individually to determine which treatment is likely to be the most successful for them. Unfortunately, for our case patient, ML, she's limited by her geography and the lack of buprenorphine waivered clinicians in her area. So because she has completed a 12-week abstinence treatment program in the past, it's more likely she'll be able to achieve induction on IM naltrexone. The great thing about the introduction of IM naltrexone for opioid use disorder for AmCare pharmacists is that we can really take the lead in managing these patients in the outpatient setting. For example, we can screen our patients for opioid use disorder, we can prescribe IM naltrexone under a CPA, we can administer the monthly dose to the patient while monitoring for future relapse, and in my experience, primary care providers have little knowledge of IM naltrexone, so I think this is an area where pharmacists can truly provide value to both the provider's office and their patients.
Well, Jordan, I really want to thank you for joining me today to discuss the treatment of opioid use disorder and how pharmacists can both refer patients to treatment, but also to make treatment more accessible. It's clear from your comments that you believe that extended release naltrexone given intramuscularly has the potential to be used in a much wider population than we currently are able to treat. And pharmacists can make a big difference in making the treatment more accessible. Well, tell us what you think. Only iFormRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormRx. It's free. Sign up today. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.